Blog Talk Radio.
Hour for Thursday, March 3rd, 2011. It's now just a few minutes after 9 o'clock, and the subject tonight will be the American Celtic Neo-Pagan expression, specifically the Roebuck, which is also called the Clan of Tubal-Cain, and in its earlier American version, the Order of 1734. Now, the elders of this tradition are Ann and Dave Finnan, who are with us here in the studio. Ann is the author of The Forge of Tubal-Cain, which came out in 2008, and has been our guest before discussing magical hypnosis. Now, the main book behind Roy Bauer's unique expression of modern neo-paganism was Robert Graves' The White Goddess, which was published in 1948. And this was also a major influence on Fred Adams of Farfaria. So here we are, and we're going to get into this fascinating material, and the Finnans are going to tell us how it developed over here and how they went over to England and brought back more of it and developed this very fascinating witchcraft tradition. Now I'm going to give it over to Ann Finnan and let her give us a history of the development of the Roebuck.
Well, thanks, Polk. One of the things that stand out in our little quest to develop the Roebuck and the greater tradition of the Clan of Tubal-Cain, which we share with our brothers and sisters in England, is it has a lot to do with the development of the craft itself in the Southern California area in the early 1970s. And a pivotal figure in that development was a fellow by the name of Joe Wilson, who will always remain in our memory as the sort of the demon guru that taught us a great deal about things. But in those early days, the only source of craft and magic was either ceremonial magic, a la OTO, or the Gardnerian movement, which started in Long Island, New York, in the late 60s. And we had originally come into things studying with the Gardnerian high priest by the name of Ed Fitch. And we were proteges of Ed for a while, but he didn't have a Gardnerian high priestess to run his own coven. So we were handed off to another couple by the name of Bill and Helen Mose, who ran a group of a tradition called the American tradition, for want of a better term, and it was a kind of a combination of Gardnerian and Alexandrian practices. But there was some stuff in there that wasn't Alexandrian or Gardnerian or wasn't ceremonial magic at all, and it intrigued us. And that led us to Joe Wilson, which eventually led us to the work of Robert Cochran or Roy Bauer's.
Yeah, Joe Wilson was the fellow that initiated me into his version of this, which he called the Order of 1734. Now, David Anna pointed out to me that Roy Bowers, who wrote under the name of Robert Cochrane over in England, Roy Bowers founded this Celtic white goddess-based Wiccan tradition over there around 1948, 1949, in that area. And he never called it the Order of 1734, although 1734 was the code for the goddess in the tradition that Roy Bowers came up with. And he had given, Wilson corresponded with him, and Roy gave him a series of letters, and so Joe developed this 1734, what he called a 1734 tradition over here, initiated myself and my wife at that time into it, he and his lady Mara. We have some video, by the way, which we were looking at earlier, some video that from one of those original 1734 initiation rituals that that features the old Joe Wilson, well, not even old, I mean at that time, and Mara doing this, and this is fascinating. We hope somehow or other we can get this this piece with Ann and Dave's permission on the air, YouTube-ish or something like that, so you can see it. So Joe Wilson, he was quite a character. He really, we can tell Joe Wilson stories all night, but that's not what we're here for. So essentially, what I want to do is I want to get Ann and Dave to tell us more about how this developed and how they took what they got from Joe and then went over to England, got more of the tradition and got it together. So I'm going to give it back to Ann. Ann, keep going here and tell us about how the roebuck came about.
Well, the roebuck came about sort of as a last-ditch effort to keep us working in the craft. Every coven that we joined prior to that disintegrated for a variety of reasons, and we ended up with some of Ed's old people and a few other folk that didn't have a home. So we decided to take the material that we had learned from Joe that he had developed, he and Mara had developed from the Roy Bowers letters, and try to make it workable. The letters themselves were not really a tradition. They were a series of philosophical musings on the nature of a dark goddess that Roy would never name. And we were trying to figure out a way of constructing rituals around the idea of this black goddess, this dark goddess, and whose name, by the way, was hinted at in the numbers 1, 7, 3, and 4 that Graves talks about in The White Goddess. So the only ritual we had from Roy was a description of a ritual that he was supposed to have done in a cave back in the early 60s. And that was what Joe and Mara and a few other people had filmed that Polk was talking about. This is a film that we digitized that is one of the few rituals that were actually filmed by Joe in those days. And it involved something that the Gardnerians simply didn't do, and that is the main part of it was carving a moat, a literal track in the ground. And you carve this little moat in the sod. And Joe would take a cauldron of boiling water and fill the moat. So you basically had the circle set off from the outside world by this stream of water. And we were to find out later that one of the basic parts of the way Roy worked was to cross the moat or cross the river literally on a bridge from this world to the other world. So it it ended up being less ceremonial and more shamanic. This is a way of working where you are traveling between the worlds. And that had intrigued us really more than anything else. And we decided to take that little bit and elaborate on it and try to build a tradition around it, which is what ended up as the Boba.
Now, to get back to the White Goddess, which of course was the inspiration for Roy originally, and in the White Goddess, if this is what's been referred to as the thinking witch's handbook. In other words, there's another one. The arrow and the, what is this, the arrow and the sword, the arrow and the chalice or something. There's another book that's almost as deep as the White Goddess. Yeah. Arrow and the Sword, that's right, Dave. And that was almost as deep as the White Goddess, but the White Goddess is deep and hard to get through, and it's hard done, but oh, it is packed. It's just packed with all this wonderful imagery. And one of the things the White Goddess does, which really relates, I think, to the Roebuck 1734 and all this, at least as far as I know, is that it ties in classical mythology and even biblical mythology, classical mythology, marching all the way up through into the Celtic lore, ties it all together, because Robert Graves is a consummate scholar and a poet, and he weaves all this together. And so what he's done with this is he's recreated the wisdom of the Druids, because the Druids, as I'm sure most of us know, the Druid tradition was wiped out by the Romans. The Romans went on a rampage to wipe out the Druids. They destroyed everything, all the wisdom of the Druids, and they didn't want them to survive, because they were, you know, they were behind the rebellion of the French. The Gauls rebelled, and the Druids led that revolt against the Romans. And Boudica, the queen, the warrior queen, the Druids were behind her revolt against the Romans. And so the Romans just went and destroyed everything they could to the Druids. And Robert Graves put it back together. So Roy Bowers is drawing from this White Goddess. Now, one of the things that is very fascinating in here, in the Roebuck tradition, And the White Goddess brings it in, is the figure of Tubal Cain, the mythological blacksmith. And this comes all the way from ancient Canaan, from our god Kothor in ancient Canaan, the blacksmith god. And I like, and Anne's book, of course, is called The Forge of Tubal Cain. So I think this is a fascinating thing. So I'm going to turn it back to Anne and tell us about Tubal Cain, Anne.
Well, Tubal Cain is an interesting figure that we discovered along with the whole idea of the blacksmith being a magician, a person who takes rock and turns it into steel that can be forged into a variety of useful things. You have to remember at this time, this is the end of the Bronze Age, and the Scythian warriors, who were these semi-mythical warrior tribes that came streaming out of the Caucasus Mountains in about 5,000 years BC, and they were horsemen. And they were able to harness the power of steel, not only in their weaponry and their swords, which could cut through a bronze sword like anything, but they also were able to make horseshoes for their horses. So they come blasting out across the steppes of what is now Russia, and they were able to conquer a lot of the tribes that were still in the Bronze Age. So they had a sort of semi-mythical character, and they were reputed to be magicians, a tribe of magicians. Tubal was a city-state on the shore of the Black Sea in the Caucasus Mountains. And Cain is a worker in metals. So Tubal Cain was the blacksmith or the metal worker of Tubal. And but when you get back to the Bible, you get a whole different idea about Tubal Cain and his family from the Book of Enoch, which is a book that did not end up in the Bible for a variety of very obvious reasons. And Tubal Cain was the grandson of Cain and Abel fame. And they were a family of magicians, of people who were had secret knowledge and were able to do unnatural things. So having that myth coupled with the whole idea of the Scythians being these mythical, magical warriors that had the swords and the horseshoes were part of this lore that rose up in Western Europe to basically explain why there were people that knew how to do things that nobody else did.
And, of course, the Celts were their smithing tradition. That goes back all the way back to the early Bronze Age and in Central Europe. And you know, the Celts had a very fascinating civilization. You can call them barbarians if you want to, but there were skills and magical skills that they had that were really remarkable. One thing I like to mention here too is that there's a strong theory that King Arthur, the Arthurian tradition, was originally Scythian, and that the Romans brought these horsemen over to Britain as mercenaries, and that they brought these Scythian traditions with them, and that the Holy Grail and the sword and the stone and all this is originally supposed to be, according to this idea, Sarmatian. So, and let's also not forget that the original inspiration for the Greek philosophers, Pythagoras, Empedocles, Parmenides, and all that, supposedly, and there's very good solid evidence for this, that came from the Scythians all the way from the Altai Mountains, all the way down that river of grass into ancient Greece. And so all this ties together. I think this is absolutely, and the horse people. Now one of the things that I did when I did my 1734 initiation, the horse skull, the horse people, and the whole idea of the sword and the horse. And this is just carries into this and echoes into this ancient tradition. However, we also, what Dave and Ann did is they blended this into the Celtic, which is where it ends up, into the Celtic tradition, giving us the goddess and the gods of the Celtic tradition. And you want to tell us how you managed to do that?
Well, some of the earliest material that we ended up with from Roy via Joe Wilson that we managed to confirm years later when we met with Evan John Jones, who was Roy's man in black or sort of second in command of his coven back then. Roy had a system that was based on the quarters. Not so much the elemental quarters, but the Erz, which was a kind of it had to do with ley lines. That's probably a whole other show. but it had different elemental associations than the Golden Dawn system, which the Gardnerian tradition was based on. And it consisted of four castles or citadels at each of the four quarters. And each of these castles had an elemental king that was guarding the sacred space or the circle or the Kershi, which is the world between worlds that you go to when you cross the river and end up in the magical space. And these four quarter kings sounded, the names that we were given sounded very, very much like certain Celtic deities that we had read about in the White Goddess and in Charles Squire's Celtic Myth and Legend. And we figured this could not have been coincidence. So we did some more research and we set up a quarter system with those four castles and those four guardians. And we went one step further and set up a goddess cross quarters system, where that ended up with an eight-spoked wheel of the quarters and then the cross quarters. So we ended up with eight Celtic, not just Irish, but Welsh and Gaulish deities that matched the descriptions we were given, and that became our quarter system. And these deities over the years have been not only guardians, but they have been invoked and have given messages, and we visit them in path workings and guided meditations. And also they have become very much an elder crew that help us to navigate our way through this labyrinth.
Yeah, the shamanic aspect of your tradition, and from what I recall, from what Joe got us into, the shamanic aspect is absolutely fascinating. Joe Wilson, we can tell Joe stories. I think that one Joe story that we all got a laugh over, and Dave's sitting over here with some kind of I'm not going to plug whatever reading device it is, but he's got one of these little electronic books here, and no sooner did I mention this than he brought up a picture of it. Joe Wilson going to a costume party, stark naked, with this little plastic helmet on, with the little horns, and they ask him, well, what are you? And he said, I'm a plastic gardenerian. Joe was a wild character, but Joe was a shaman, and Joe did path workings that, oh boy, when you did path workings with Joe, you better have your head screwed on straight, because where you were going, with Joe, it could get pretty wild. And Joe was really a great urban shaman. One thing though, Joe kind of gave up on 1734. But the reason, that's not because it wasn't a great tradition. It was because Joe just went from one thing to another. He was off on the American Indian. He had a little American Indian blood in him, and he was off being an American Indian for a while. And then he got into Tibetan Buddhism, and all that was his big thing. He was in the OTA for a while, But the thing that I know Dave and Ann carried on, the legacy from Joe was his shamanic ability. And Joe, one of the things that really impressed me about the Roebuck is this wonderful process of the assumption of the god form and the goddess form. And this is where they don't just do a seasonal ceremony. The individual who is going to do the god or the goddess spends the whole day out in the wilderness setting, meditating on the form of the god and the goddess. And so when they do the ceremony, that individual is the god and the goddess. And this is different. I don't know any other group that does this. And we do something similar, but not for seasonals. We don't do that. And but the Roebuck does, and this is very, very effective. You want to talk about that a little bit, Ann?
Well, this is also a shamanic function. It's nowadays it's called channeling. It's you basically become the physical vehicle for whatever being is being asked into the circle to communicate with who's ever in there. It's an ancient priesthood function. It's the oracle at Delphi. It's that kind of becoming the mouthpiece for the divine being who has something to say to someone. And we got to the point where we not only do it, we teach it. And it's actually not hard to learn if you have a modicum of psychic ability, and most people do. It just needs to be activated. But it's a way of doing it where you have maximum effectiveness with a minimum amount of risk. This sort of stuff shouldn't be soul-destroying. If you're doing that, then you're doing it wrong. So it's a priesthood function. It's what the ancient priesthood in these shamanic cultures would do. They would be a physical vehicle for whatever their god was and minister to the people in a variety of ways. So it's not hard, but it is something that we take very, very seriously. And it's not something that we do just to freak people out. So that's the story behind that. And I will hand it over to Dave here for a moment, and he will elaborate on that a bit.
Hello, this is Dave. I got permission from my wife to speak, so I will. A couple things. We have been very fortunate, Ann and I. We built our tradition on the backs of a whole bunch of teachers. Ed Fitch, Pope Runyon, Joe Wilson, Evan John Jones, Bill Gray, and many others who I just can't recall right now over the years working with them. A couple things I wanted to state was Roy Bauer's group was the Klein and Tubal Gain. And I talked to Evan John Jones trying to get a little bit of the back history on it. And according to him, he met Roy in 1964. And he was told at that time, or told by Roy, that Roy had had another group for the previous 2 years. So what we know as the Klein and Tubal Gain only started in the early 60s. So it doesn't go that far back. And I could give a few other things, but I think, you got to remember that Roy died in 1966. He was only 33, so he was a very brilliant young man, and he could have contributed a lot more to the pagan philosophy and history if he'd been able to stick around for a while. Anyway, I'm going to give it back to Angie and get back to Polk.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Before we, or in the break between our first attempt to get this across and this final one, we were talking about this business of our channeling and our the magic that we are able to accomplish, And you know, we all agreed that there aren't any secrets anymore. I mean, everything, and this is why we're on blog radio. This is why we're being so frank and honest about all of this, and we're not trying to lure you into some secret thing that you have to go to. No, because we realize now, in the information age, and there's so much information out there that you're overwhelmed with it. And anything you want to know, you can probably find it on Wikipedia. There isn't, you know, we don't have any secrets anymore. But what we do have still to offer, and you're not going to get it, I don't think, anyplace else, is the training and the guidance to actually learn how to do this work. That's what we can teach you. That's what we still have to offer. Not secrets. It's how to work with this no longer secret material, no longer secret traditions. Yeah, sure, you can find out all about what we do, but if you really want to learn how to do it, then you better get down and do the work. That's what we're trying to tell you. And if you do this work, you don't have to go and pay $1,500 for some seminar or some workshop where some to listen to some woman or some man prancing around and give with a Hindu accent telling you, "Lord, my masters, I am giving you all the secrets of the ancients. Oh yes, I am channeling the great Rumpadumpa. Oh yes, you don't need to. You can do it yourself. You can get in touch with the great Rumpadumpa if you want to. But you're going to have to come to people like us who can train you to do it." And so, you know, forget about all the secrets. We'll give you all the secrets. We'll tell you all the secrets. But it's doing the work. That's what we want to try to get across. That this tradition, these traditions, well, the Roebuck is a wonderful example of this. And so tell us about your training program, man, because you got a training manual and you guys really know how to do it.
Well, the training manual kind of grew up out of the need to take people in and give them the skills that they needed to do the kind of shamanic work we were doing. A lot of that involves things like visualization, which most people can do if they know that's what they're doing. Also things like trance induction. When I was on Polk's show earlier, we talked about auto-hypnosis and the process of putting yourself into an altered state of awareness. We don't hypnotize people. We teach people how to hypnotize themselves so they know that when they go into the temple or they go into the circle or they cross that bridge from this world to the next world, they are in an altered state and they can do the work that they need to do, whatever it is that we're doing. There are ways of teaching people. There are ways of allowing people to learn. And we have a whole year-long training program that we use to help people learn what they've already learned in childhood and just forgot, you know, the dreaming, the imagination, going into the state where everything is magic and you're not thinking too hard. And when you cross that bridge from the other world to this world, you have to switch consciousness. You're just flipping a switch from one way of thinking to another. And one of the reasons Polk and I were talking earlier about the unfortunate use of mind-altering substances that grew up in the 60s is that you can't switch that off very easily. So when people have to drive home after ritual, it becomes rather problematic. So we had to find a way of helping people to make that switch without, you know, substance hangovers, and which could cause issues. So it was a 20-year-long process, and we had to reinvent the wheel. But I think we've managed to at least give people keys that they can take and run with it and use to come into contact with whatever gods they like. They don't have to be Celtic gods. We've had people try these techniques with Egyptian gods or Norse gods or a variety of other pantheons. So it's not necessarily Celtic. The differences, I think, with the Celts was that they were they made this into an art form, particularly with their use of poetry. And if you read some of the ancient Celtic poems, they're pathworkings. They take you to the other realm with imagery. And I think this is ultimately what Robert Graves was trying to say in The White Goddess, is that this is the word, this is the poem that will take you to the other world. And Roy Bowers was very much a proponent of that. And for him showing us the way, we are extremely grateful.
Hello, Dave again. I'm going to let you all in on a little secret. All magic depends on your visualization, your magical trance work, and you put yourself into it. If you were fortunate enough to go to Polk's seasonal ceremonies and see his elaborate temple and the magical tools and tablets he's built over the years, you know, these are very impressive. They make it easier, but they're not necessary. If you can visualize and concentrate on those images, that's the secret key to working magic. Seeing it in your mind and feeling it. And I'm going to pass this on to Ann.
I'm going to let Polk answer that one.
Oh, yeah, I got a good answer to that one. I like all my toys, and I really enjoy it because, you know, I used to work for Ringling Brothers Circus, and so I love to build the equipment, and somebody said one time, he said, well, OTA temples look like Hollywood movie sets, and so we ended up making a Hollywood type movie, just, you know, in which we used them. But anyway, no, however, what we have, and Joe Wilson actually, you know, he had a few things to say about our yoga system. One of them was we ought to use it in Galatia, which we did. If you have a good internal yoga system, like our Hermetic yoga system, which, frankly, I think, in our case, it'll work. You can take our Hermetic yoga system and you can plug in all of your robot deities right into it, and it'll work. And you can take the Egyptian deities, and you can plug them into it, and it'll work. And you can take the Greek pantheon, you plug it into it, and it'll work. Canaanite, of course, it's designed for the Canaanite, but that's because it fits on the Kabbalah. But all you can take, if you've got those psychic centers inside you, if you've got the gods and the goddesses inside you, you don't need a temple. You don't need a bunch of tools. You don't need robes. You don't need anything. You just sit down, shut up, and get in. Get in. But I think I want to sell Hermetic yoga to the Roebuck. Okay. Anyway, but let's talk a little bit, if we can, a little bit about the White Goddess and how the White Goddess of the tree alphabet, in other words, You guys used the tree alphabet, I imagine. And the tree alphabet, of course, had a lot of influence on Fred Adams on Ferrofaria. And we used the tree alphabet in one of our path workings in the OTA. And so this tree alphabet, and all magical systems have to have an alphabet. You know, you got a good magical system, it's got to have a magical alphabet. So let's talk a little bit about some of the mechanics in the White Goddess, huh?
By mechanics, I think we're talking about the tree alphabet and how it's arranged. It's arranged very much like Norse runes, and they're used very much like that. One of the things that we're finding out about Om, or Ogham to those who don't speak Gaelic, is that it's a relatively recent invention, and they were used primarily to hide a lot of their lore from the Romans, which it served a very good purpose that way. But also, one of the reasons why the Druid lore and practices are so mysterious is they didn't write them down. Several reasons for that. Not only because they don't want the Romans reading over their shoulder, but also, when you write something down, it solidifies it. It stops being a living, fluid tradition and becomes holy writ. And the Druids were very worried that their traditions would become ensconced in stone so that they couldn't live. And they didn't write their traditions down. A lot of them couldn't have been written down simply because they were so internal and so personal to whoever was doing the work. It would be like trying to write down some of the Native American shamanic traditions. It didn't make any sense to anybody who wasn't a Druid. But they also used them for capturing magic in much the same way that that the runes did. They were used for inscriptions on tombstones and standing stones. They were used as formulae that were carved into staves, and they were used for divination. They were used to tell fortunes and to basically like rune stones would be used today. I have a set of Om staves, which are basically bits of wood that have the Oms carved in them.
Anne, why don't you tell the folks about the Om staves you put up on the roof of the temple?
Well, that's another use of the Om. They were guardian trees. They formed a sacred grove or a nematon, which was the place of the gods. And if you had the sacred grove with all of the chieftain trees, then that was basically your cathedral. And you would, if you were a druid or part of a druidic family, it was a caste system after all, you would go into the nematon to hold councils and decide important things about the tribe and such. So we decided that we were going to have our very own nematon. And since a converted garage in Southern California doesn't lend itself too well to lots of trees, we carved the Om in basically popsicle sticks and hung them on a string on the roof of the temple. So now we have our very own nematon. And we have to point that out to people when they come into the temple for the first time. Just look up. There's your nematon. So they marked the seasons of the year. Each Om had its own month and its own god and goddess and its own attributes and things. So we have our very own little nematon on the roof of the temple.
Yeah, and we have that deodar that Fred and Spinona or Sashes are buried under. And I keep me thinking that I'm going to build a tree house up in there in that 100-foot tree sometime. To get back to the neo-Celtic pagan tradition, I think that when you get into this, you buy into, in a sense, the entire mystical tradition of the British Isles. And this includes Leolines, which you mentioned before. It includes the Glastonbury legends. It works itself in even into, whether you should mention this, mystical Christianity, Joseph of Arimathea, and all the rest of that good stuff. The Holy Grail. Of course, the Holy Grail. You know, I remember Monty Python, of course, and with the Fred Foote. Yes. I say, do I have a Holy Grail? Yes, sir, we have a Holy Grail. Ah, Holy Grail is better than your Holy Grail, you stupid English person, you. So the French, the English are arguing about the Holy Grail. But you get into this, this is the great thing about having a British-based tradition. You buy into all this wonderful legendary, and you can just kind of work it all in. And that's why I think that I suspect a little bit of the Tubal Cain comes kind of that's British, a little bit of British masonry maybe creeping in there, you know, because Tubal Cain figures strongly in British masonry. Bay a little bit, maybe, a little influence, but that's all right because it's all part of this British tradition, you know. And you tell us a little bit before we sign off here about your experiences over in Britain, because I know we just saw Joe Carson's wonderful film, Dancing with Gaia, and you're in that. You're in the film. So tell us a little bit about your adventures over in Britain.
Well, we've been over there four times now, and every time has been more interesting than the last. The first time was actually meeting Evan John Jones and working with him up on the old hill fort up behind Brighton and talking about ritual equipment, and all we had was a hunting knife and a bottle of Guinness, and that was the ritual regalia of the evening, and we went up on this old hill fort and cut a circle in the turf with the knife and drained the bottle of Guinness and went traveling over the river into the other world and it was a fascinating experience, and the subsequent trips were studying with John and getting information from him, and then basically visiting every ruined castle and stone circle that we could find up and down the tiny isle. And this latest trip was actually finding the remnants of John's group, because he, after we had studied with him, he had formed another group of his own that practiced a lot of these things. And so we had to, the kids had to have a family reunion here. So we came back with a lot of rocks and photos of ruined castles and some tremendous amount of further lore to experiment with. So we did the magical mystery tour on a couple of occasions and visiting all of the ancient sites. And there's one thing about Americans that we've had to tell our British brethren. It's one thing to read about it in a book and see a picture. It's a whole other thing to stand in the middle of one of these stone circles on a full moon night and listen to all of the owls and the night birds and all the strange things that go on in those stone circles at night.
One of the most interesting things we rituals we did was 1982s. We were in the Welsh countryside with two lovely people let us stay with them for a couple days. I went out to this ritual circle, and it was a heavy mist, a little light rain. So we did a little meditation, thanked the old ones, the gods, for the trip going so well and so forth. And after doing our meditation, we decided we were all ready to leave. And we turned and just stepped out of the circle when galloping to us. I remember, there was four of us there, and galloping at us were four white horses. Now, you couldn't ask for anything more magical than that.
To this day, we don't know if they were physical horses or not, but actually, it didn't matter. It was a one of those pats on the head from the other world saying, I think you found something there, kids. And it made us feel that we had come home, that we had found the well that we would continue to drink from for the next 20 years. So it can happen. It does happen. But it happens on their timetable, not on yours.
Yeah, that's fascinating, and we got about 6 minutes left. And so I think with the 6 minutes we have remaining, let's kind of summarize what we've covered, which is the proper thing to do in a case like this. So what we've had as our distinguished guests, the elders of the Roebuck tradition, and by the way, one thing we didn't get into, and I want to get into it right quick before we start. The Roebuck, the name Roebuck, as I recall, derives from a poem in the White Goddess, doesn't it? And Anne's nodding her head here. And I don't know how much you can tell us about that, but you might want to tell us just a little bit.
The Roebuck was one of the three magical treasures that the magician Gwydion seeks when he storms the underworld in the poem where he invades the realm of Anuin, and he is seeking three magical treasures: the Roebuck, which hides the secret; the Lapwing, which disguises the secret; and the Dog, which guards the secret. So we are one of the three treasures of Anuin that the magician is seeking. Interestingly enough, when Gwydion storms the underworld, he has an interesting army. It's an army of trees.
I wonder if old Professor Tolkien made some use of that. Probably. Anyway, so, to summarize what we've covered here, we started off with Dave and Ann Finnan, who are, you know, the elders of the Roebuck and the clan of Tubal Cain. And this, of course, was it was originally brought over here to this country by the famous or infamous Joe Wilson, and called the Order of 1734. Joe called it that, based upon the code name for the Dark Goddess in Roy Bauer's tradition. Now, Dave and Ann got into that with Joe and really, really became fascinated with it and kept it up after Joe gave it up. They kept it. They went over, as they have explained to us, went over to England, found the original people that had bought. Roy had already passed on, but they found the original people, worked with him. They brought back the secrets and the tradition and, you know, the authentic tradition. I mentioned this, by the way, in the cipher manuscript book that they had done the right thing, gone back over there and got the real stuff rather than just depending upon the letters that Roy wrote to Joe. Now, Dave's holding up a cord. That's Roy Bauer's cord. How many knots are on that cord?
Eight.
Oh, hey. Oh, yeah. Well, we know what to do with those cords, don't we? Yeah. Anyway, yeah, that's fascinating. Well, that's, yeah, Roy Barrow's original cord. And maybe we can show you that on some YouTube video, I hope. But Dave and Ann really established a very solid, authentic organization here. And we mentioned several times the heritage of the White Goddess, Robert Graves' White Goddess. We also discussed, and we will plug again, The Forge of Tubal-Cain by Ann Finnan, the book on most of what we've been discussing this evening. Next week, we're going to, hopefully, the Seventh Ray will be back from the printers by next week, and we can get into that. If it's not, we'll come up with another fascinating topic, and we'll see you then, and good magic.